Women's Day with 14 hours of programming. From 8 a.m. to 10 p.m., we will highlight female programmers, musicians, activists, artists, and athletes. Women's equality has made positive gains, but the world is still unequal. International Women's Day celebrates the social, political, and economic achievements of women while focusing attention on areas that require further action. Our 14 hours of International Women's Day programming is one of thousands of events throughout the world honoring the role of women. Join us on CITR 101.9 FM from 8 to 10 on March 8th and be inspired. For more information about the programming schedule, visit www.citr.ca.
here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Why is there even Women's Day? Why can't there be Men's Day too? Asked a male classmate of mine yesterday. Women's Day is an international celebration that I was never taught to celebrate from an early age. As we celebrate Soldiers on Remembrance Day, Santa on Christmas, and Cinnamon Hearts on Valentine's Day, never once through elementary school to high school did I learn that there was such a celebration as International Women's Day. With this lack of knowledge came an indifference to how long women before me had fought so I could get a job, an education, and a sense of inclusion in the world. Maybe this ignorance of the struggle behind women's rights led me to believe that women have equal positions in society and always have. Yet, this isn't the reality of the situation. And in factual response to my classmate's naive question, here's a brief overview of why it exists and why it matters in Canada. Financially, women in Canada who work full-time earn about 71 cents for every dollar earned by men. This gap persists even when women have the same education experience as men. Even when more graduate from university, they aren't earning as much as men. And on average, while university-educated women earn $62,800 a year, men earn $91,800. The unpaid work that women do goes largely unnoticed as well. And each day, as men and women work about the same number of hours, women statistically do more unpaid work. While men put in 2.2 hours, women put in 4.2 hours. As primary caretakers of children, it is women that are most affected by Canada's lack of affordable childcare. And workplace policies such as flex time and caregiver leave. This often forces women into career choices that severely limit their earning power. There is a high price to pay for being a mother. There are now twice as many working women in Canada as there were 30 years ago. This ranks as one of the most dramatic social changes in the last century, but the failure of our government and employers to adequately respond to this new reality leaves women at an incredible disadvantage. Politically, women currently earn about 22.1% of Parliament, account for 22.1% of Parliament, as men, even though they make up 50% of the population. Under the Harper government, the phrase gender equality was eliminated from the mandate of Status of Women Canada. 12 out of 16 Status of Women offices have been closed, and funding for the women's advocacy organization has been relocated. While funding for the Court Challenges Program, which helped women pursue equality rights in the court, has been eliminated. The government has also gotten rid of the $5 billion over 5 years National Child Care Program. Socially, half of women in Canada have experienced at least one incident of physical or sexual violence since the age of 16. Half, 50%. On average, every 6 days, a woman in Canada is killed by her intimate partner. On any given day in Canada, more than 3,300 women, along with 3,000 children, are forced to sleep in an emergency shelter to escape domestic violence. Every night, 200 women are turned away because the shelters are full. As of 2010, there were 582 known cases of missing or murdered Aboriginal children or women in Canada. Both Amnesty International and the United Nations have called upon the Canadian government to take action on this issue without success. In a 2009 Canadian National survey, women reported 460,000 incidences of sexual abuse in just 1 year, and only about 10% of all sexual assaults are reported to the police. This is just a small handful of introductory information about the disadvantaged place women have in Canadian society. So to my friend who wondered about why Women's Day exists, why does it matter, and why don't we have Men's Day? Well, according to research-based evidence and facts, it seems that until we can reach a point of gender equality in Canada and the world, every day is Men's Day.
Welcome to a special International Women's Day edition of News 101 here at CITR, UBC's campus radio station. Today we have stories and discussions focused on how women are involved in the media through film, radio, and journalism, and print.
Today is Saturday, March 8th, 2014. And we are your hosts, Nina Krigia,
Christine Kim,
and Rachel Bergen. Thank you for being with us.
Our first piece is brought to us by Mormé Zinc. Mormé discusses the way female authors' book covers are designed. The way female authors' book covers are designed affects the way the general public perceives their work. She spoke with students from UBC's campus earlier in the week.
Hello, everyone. My name is Mormé Zanke, and I'm really excited to be a part of FemCon. I think this is a great opportunity to talk about feminism and issues that are happening in the world right now. I decided to take this opportunity to discuss an issue that's been on my mind, and that's the prejudice I feel the market has on female writers. So this was first brought to my attention by Maureen Johnson, who is a young adult novelist, who was talking about how books written by women tend to have girly covers despite their content, while books written by men have boy covers, have more darker tones, whereas girls kind of have those soft tones and kind of appeal only to the female audience. So she had a little contest in 2013 called A Cover Flip, where she asked her fans to take books written by one gender and change the cover so it looked like it was written by the opposite gender. And this is obviously by the publisher's standards and the standards that have been put in place by the market. And so there were a few funny results with that switch, especially when books written by men were given the market's girly covers. And so it just goes to show that there is a prejudice out there. Sometimes guys steer away from reading books written by females just because of what the cover looks like. They kind of are turned away from reading it because the cover that the publishers put out aren't exactly welcoming to you know, a guy that wants to read the book. And that limits the spectrum and the audience that a female writer can reach out to when the content could be exactly the same as a book written by a man. So I wanted to take Maureen Johnson's contest one step further, and I developed my own tiny experiment using UBC students as my participants. So I provided two thriller books, one written by Chevy Stevens, a female author, called Always Watching, and one written by Robert Cray called Suspect. These two authors both write in the genre of thriller and were both on the New York Times best-selling author list for some of their books. So the content of their books are generally the same, they fit in the same genre, and yet the book written by Chevy Stevens has a girly cover with the back of a woman looking out on a lake, there's soft tones of blue, the hair is flowing in the wind. It is more of a girly cover, to use a term that Maureen Johnson coined. Now, Robert Cray's book, Suspect, has a silhouette of a wolf in the bottom right corner overlooking a red cityscape, and his name is in bold white letters that, like, takes up half of the cover. So, yeah, it's more of a guy's book by the publisher standards. They're reaching out and trying to reach out to the men who want to read these books. So there are different kind of distinct categories that these books fall under, although they are both still thriller books. So yeah, I thought this was perplexing, and so I decided to give the participants in the study the name of the books, but allocate phony names of the opposite gender to each book. So I told them Chevy Stevens' book Always Watching was written by a Jacob Moore, and Robert Cray's Suspect was written by a Sophia Wilson. And then I asked them to describe the cover and what they thought that would look like. I wanted to see if the prejudice existed in a population of readers also, or if it was just a prejudice created in the market. And so these were the results. So I'm going to start with Always Watching, written in reality by Chevy Stevens, but I told people it was written by a Jacob Moore.
Always Watching. So I see this one as someone, probably like an older gentleman with binoculars, like staring out, like focusing on this like woman who's like in front of him. Maybe it's like a bright out daylight, and they're like in public, but he's still he's watching her, and he's dressed in black to symbolize his like evil character, and then she's dressed in more bright colors because she's the good character, and seen as like the victim maybe, or they'd be in like some sort of building. Maybe he's peeking out from outside.
Probably something with eyes, I would imagine. So, like, I don't know, maybe like a TV or a movie screen, possibly. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you watch those.
Taken from the title, I would have to... I would go with more of, like, a black color or... And, like shadowy figures, maybe. Or a clock.
Always watching. I feel like it would be like someone looking out from a window. Like you're looking up at the window and there's like a person looking out the window at you. Mm. Yeah.
Cool. Oh, okay. Well, Big Brother eyes. And I... yeah. Big Brother eyes.
So there's like an armchair facing towards a window, and you see a silhouette of a figure, but you don't really see it, and you just assume that he's staring outside the window, and outside the window, it's like not a, it's, I guess it could be a cityscape outside of the window.
So most people have images that are stark. Lots of people said like eyes were a theme, clocks, images that were definitely not girly, as Chevy Stevens' book has been portrayed by publishers. And so that's an interesting kind of component that, but then we have to ask ourselves, was that because the name that I gave them was Jacob Moore? And so the next component, what the cover would be for Suspect, written by a Sophia Wilson versus Robert Cray, is very illuminating, and we are going to take a listen to that right now.
Suspect. It would be a dark cover, probably lots of dark colors like gray and black and maybe some browns. Maybe it'd be like a picture of a person looking very suspicious, like maybe running away or hiding, and maybe like blood on the ground, and maybe like a weapon on the ground as well, laying beside the blood.
I don't know, I imagine it would just be like a silhouette of some guy with like a fedora, like a detective, mm-hmm, or something. Monochromatic, like black on probably like a light brown or gray kind of color, with like really creepy writing.
Think something along the lines of like dark, mysterious, like reds and blacks, and not very clear cut, but kind of like shaded, I suppose.
I'm seeing, like, a person from behind. So you can't see their face and they're, like, in a forest or something. I don't know. That's what I think of. Okay.
Minimalistic with the author's name on the bottom in that John Grisham kind of text. And lots of red, black, and white.
So, there's like a desk, like a brown desk, and on the desk all you see is just like a magnifying glass. And at the bottom you just see the title, The Suspect.
What do you know? These students did not pay attention to the gender of the author. Or if they did, they did not allocate a girly cover to Robert Cray's book. They just solely took the name and said, hey, let's create a book cover that represents the name of this book. And it actually turns out that what they said aligns very well to what Robert Cray's cover actually looks like. Lots of reds, ominous background. And so it just goes to show readers don't necessarily hold that prejudice. And maybe it's the market that is proposing that prejudice and causing there to be that distinction. I found this to be very illuminating. Most people don't hold any prejudice based on gender, at least from this small study that I did, this sample study. Of course, there are still lots of questions to be asked and a lot of things to be changed about the system. I really wish, personally, that there was no prejudice, that a book was a book and it didn't matter who wrote it, but there are still remnants of that bias towards women in the market, which is really too bad, and I hope that we can resist against that and we don't have to be defined by our gender and we can just be defined by the work that we produce. So this was just a small study stressing that there are actually no prejudices from the readers that I interviewed, and that the prejudice does exist in the market. And that's something that is a little scary, but hopefully if we just are aware of the issue and if we resist against this, change can occur and equality can occur in these environments. So thank you for listening to this small segment on the prejudice on female writers in the market. I had a good time listening to people's responses, and I'd like to pose a question to you guys. You know, last time you went to the library, did you notice this prejudice? And if so, did it prevent you from buying a book or picking up a book that you would have wanted to read? Or in other words, I want to encourage you definitely not to base a book on its cover, because there are apparently biases in the marketplace. So, yeah. All right. Thank you for listening. Have a good night.
Thank you, Morme Zanke, for that wonderful and very intuitive, interesting piece. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but we'll be right back. Stay tuned for more FemCon programming right here on CITR 101.9 FM.
So hi, Rochelle. Thank you so much for joining us. We know things are really busy with the Vancouver International Women in Film Festival right now, so we really appreciate it.
Feminism is not a bad word. It's a movement to empower women, to end gender-based oppression, and it's a force for good on our campus. On March 10th, the feminists and feminist allies of UBC will come together to declare I Am a Feminist Day, to show that anybody can be a feminist, and to start a conversation about the place of feminism in our community. Join us in the sub for an engagement fair on Monday from 11 to 2, and show your pride on campus all day. To learn more, find our event on Facebook at I Am a Feminist Day, or on Twitter at @reclaim_consent.
The AMS Sexual Assault Support Center is happy to present its new collaboration with My Sister's Closet, a social enterprise of battered women support services. The SASC's Got Consent clothing items will be sold at My Sister's Closet, located at 1092 Seymour Street in Vancouver. The Got Consent initiative is a preventative campaign that creatively touches upon the necessity for consent to be present during all sexual encounters. The Got Consent branding is visible on a variety of clothing items, including t-shirts, underwear, and tank tops. It's also available at the SASC and the UBC Wellness Center in the sub, in addition to at My Sister's Closet. For more information on the Sexual Assault Support Center at UBC and the Got Consent campaign, go to ams.ubc.ca/SASC.
Welcome back to News 101. We're broadcasting you broadcasting to you live from CITR, UBC's campus radio station. Today we have a special International Women's Day broadcast bringing to you a full hour of independent female-produced content.
Up next on the show, we have a piece produced by our Rachel Bergen. Rachel is a student at UBC's School of Journalism, and she spoke with some of her co-students and one of her professors, Catherine Gretzinger, about the future prospects of women in the field of journalism.
I'm Rachel Bergen, a grad student at the UBC Graduate School of Journalism. We're approaching the end of classes, and for many of my classmates, graduation. Many will be entering newsrooms around the country. Most newsrooms are hectic, loud, stressful, and competitive environments. Sometimes, women fall under the radar because they lack confidence. Sachi Vikram Singh, Caitlin Verstraden, and Allison Greiner are a part of the next generation of female journalists, and they're about to enter the workforce. But I wonder, what do these journalists hope to accomplish after graduation? How do they find they get in the way of their own goals? And how have they had to change their thought patterns to get where they are now?
My name is Sachi Vikramasinghe, and this summer I'm going to be doing a CBC Joan Donaldson scholarship. It's a paid internship with the CBC in Toronto and elsewhere in the country. But I'm going to be based in Toronto, and I'm going to be doing three placements. The first is with Marketplace, and then I'm going to be chase producing for local television in Toronto, and then I'm going to be working on the community desk in Toronto. Basically, my goals as a journalist are to give voice to the stories that aren't covered in the media and to complicate those stories. It's very easy for a very narrow narrative to be created about particular stories that get repeated over and over and over again. So my goal as a journalist is to take a step back and look at those stories and say, hey, there's no one truth. Let's have a discussion about the multiple stories that are out there. So that's how I look at myself and my journalism practice. I come from an academic background as well, where I have months and months to think about a story, think about an issue, do research. And then being in the newsroom this summer, especially with CBC, where I was doing current affairs, I would always get in my own way of producing a story because I would say, you know, I don't know everything. I don't have all the research. I'm not talking to the right people. And I like all this chronic sort of disbelief and lack of confidence in my own ability to tell a story coherently and quickly. I've had several female producers actually comment on this lack of confidence in myself and a constant reminders from them to say, you're here because you deserve to be here.
My name is Caitlin Verstraten, and my plans for the summer are I'm working at the Toronto Star. I hope to, you know, bring my own unique flavor to the mix, and I think that being a female, and just my experiences with that, I can relate to a lot of the people I would speak to on a different level. I think my biggest problem is my lack of focus. I really like to do everything, and I think that's you can't. So I've been really lucky to have a lot of strong female role models in journalism that a lot of the times have to kind of yank me back to reality and set me back on course.
I'm Allison Greiner. And this summer I'm going to be at the News 21 program, which is this Carnegie Knight initiative to do in-depth and data-based reporting. And this year we're going to be looking at gun control down at Arizona State University. One thing that's been pointed out to me quite often is that I say sorry all the time. Not just a little bit. It's so bad that people mistake me for being actually Canadian and I'm American. I find that I'm, you know, apologetic about a lot of things. Sometimes it's legitimate wrongs that I've done and other times less so. It's apologizing for not necessarily knowing or not being confident in something or acting in ways that I perceive to be wrong, but no one else perceives that. So, there's that. And then there's also this kind of emotional struggle to be stoic and confident and assertive. And there's an aggressiveness to journalism that, aggressiveness is often typed as male, and I don't necessarily see myself as an aggressive person, but you realize how big a pool of talent is out there for journalists. And people are pushing you to always be forward and to be aggressive because they see that as the path to success. As going through the journalism school, I'm becoming more and more convinced that that's one way to success, but not the exclusive way.
Luckily, Sachi, Caitlin, and Allison have Catherine Gretzinger as a mentor. She's a longtime CBC radio journalist and School of Journalism adjunct professor. Catherine takes special interest in her female students.
What I spend a lot of time doing is working with young women like you to try to say you are every bit as skilled and as capable and as competent as anyone else walking into this newsroom. You need to start seeing yourself in that way. You need to go in there, and whatever is going on for you in terms of nervousness or shyness or confidence, you need to find a way to put it in your pocket and get to work. So you need to speak up, ask questions, make contributions, be willing to make mistakes from time to time, go find mentors, ask for specific feedback, and then build on that feedback. Really find a way to fully engage with what's going on and not hang back. Because if you do, one, people are going to think you're not tough enough or smart enough or sharp enough to be in the newsroom, which is ridiculous. You're ready to go. You just have to go. Or two, somebody else is going to step in and fill the void. And neither one of those are going to be good for you. I wish, this sounds like a Hallmark card or something, but I wish that my young women students would see in themselves the potential I see.
These three women took Catherine's advice seriously and earned some of the most prestigious journalism internships in Canada and the United States. This has been Rachel Bergen with CITR.
Thank you for that wonderful piece, Rachel.
Thanks. Our next segment is brought to us by Karina Bizim. If you turned into our regular broadcast yesterday, you may have caught part of it. Karina spoke with the president of Women in Film and Television Vancouver, Rochelle Chartrand. Unfortunately, Karina was not able to make it into the studio today, but she has provided us with a brief report and her interview. Here is her report. This past Sunday was Hollywood's crowning glory that is known as the Academy Awards. Every year, the top players are pitted against each other for a shot at holding that solid gold naked man with the anxious fear of the polite music coming on to shoo them off the stage. So we asked here at News 101, how did the Canadians do all of this? I spoke to senior programmer Steve Gravestock at the Toronto International Film Festival, who gave me a lowdown on how TIFF has championed the work of many Canadian filmmakers who have gone on to the Oscars, including Jean-Marc Vallée, whose film Dallas Buyers Club took home 3 wins, and Denis Villeneuve, whose film Prisoners walked out with a cinematography nomination, along with the visual effects editors who shared wins for Gravity. He says that Canadian filmmakers are always showcased at the TIFF Bell Lightbox, as well as Canada's Top 10 Film Festival, which provides major exposure and the opportunity to work with big American producers. Films that premiere alongside Oscar-nominated films like Gravity, 12 Years a Slave, Dallas Buyers Club, and Philomena at TIFF give Canadians access to a large pool of resources. But is that really what the goal is? In fact, Steve says, quote, "The Canadian Screen Awards are frankly far more interesting and unpredictable than the Oscars. There are so many amazing and wildly different films nominated," end quote. And indeed, there were this past Wednesday. But a more important issue in the film community has been the amount of female participation in the industry. Gravestock accredits TIFF to judging films simply based on quality, which is reflected in the fact that there have been years where 35 to 40% of films programmed have been directed by women, which is far above the normal statistics. And not just established female filmmakers either, but first-time directors as well. A last remark from Steve, he states that, quote, one of the craziest, wildest things I've ever saw was the bizarre Hollywood triumphalism after Catherine Bigelow won for Best Director. It was as if they'd solved the underrepresentation of women in the film industry by giving her a prize. It's hilarious and genuinely depressing at the same time, end quote. To follow up on this, we have Karina's interview with the president of Women in Film and Television Vancouver, Rochelle Chartrand.
So hi, Rochelle. Thank you so much for joining us. We know things are really busy with the Vancouver International Women in Film Festival right now, so we really appreciate it.
Thank you.
So as the president of Women in Film and Television Vancouver, can you tell us a little bit about the organization?
Yes, of course. Women in Film and Television Vancouver, we're a member-driven, not-for-profit society, and our main objectives are to further the artistic and professional development of women and to recognize and promote the artistic and professional contributions of women in Canadian screen-based media community and in the community at large. We're part of, we're one of the chapters of Women in Film and Television International, which has 40 chapters around the world. So it's really exciting.
So as it is International Women's Day on Saturday, we want to discuss the lack of presence of women in this previous Academy Awards that was this past Sunday, and in the commercial film industry in general. So what do these numbers look like? Like, what is the male versus female participation in the industry currently?
Well, we've actually, it's actually a really interesting time because for the first time there's actual hard research being done, and so we actually have these stats in numbers. I can only really speak for Canada, except I know through my own reading that they're on par with the States as well. So basically there's less than 20% of films are directed or written by women. So that's one in five, basically. And the sad thing is that it hasn't really changed over the years. We're celebrating, actually, we're celebrating our 25th anniversary today. March 6th is our official birthday. And, yeah, we're starting a year-long celebration. So it's really exciting, but it's also sobering when you look at the stats, and they haven't changed very much.
Well, happy anniversary. So do you think the problem lies more so in the lack of female directors or just females who want to get involved in the behind-the-scenes industry, or more so the industry not giving female directors enough opportunities?
Film production schools are roughly, give or take, every year, half women. So that's really interesting that they're the young girls are coming into school, but then after that there's, I don't know. It's hard to say because there are systemic issues, definitely. And if you talk television, it's a different situation than in Canada feature films where we don't have studios, but we have funding bodies. So it's kind of interesting. We're, like I said, we're really excited about these stats, but I think we can kind of lose ourselves in trying to analyze why the stats are like they are, because I, like I said, they've been like this for 25 years. Like nothing is changing. But what we do is we use these stats and we now go to the industry and say, okay, what we've been saying all along is true, like it's common sense, but now the numbers are there in writing, so now what can we do about this? What, how do we move forward instead of getting stuck in the mentality of the stats? Let's look for opportunities. So something that's really exciting that Women in Film are doing is we are just announcing tonight at the opening night of our film festival that we are creating a national genre lab, and this is through support with Super Channel, and it's so exciting because it's going to give five teams, female writer, director, and producer, all three have to be female, and it also has to be a female-driven story, and it's going to be a year-long program where we go from right from scratch, from the script, all the way through to getting funding and getting the project out into the world marketplace. And this is just the first first arm of a larger project, which is the National Accelerator Project. But for this first year, we decided to focus on genre because it's an area where women are underrepresented, but making some real inroads. And so we're so excited that Super Channel has come on board to support it in the development stage. And then they're excited about where it goes from there as well. So that's what I mean. Like, this is what we want to do instead of, like, getting stuck in the stats, because where that conversation goes could just lead us into this quicksand. We're trying to look and, you know, raise the consciousness also around audiences, you know, kind of we want to see a paradigm shift of what it means to be a female storyteller and what are women stories and who are our audience. Like, I think there's so many limiting beliefs around who the audience is for female films, female-driven films.
Yeah, I'm really glad that you mentioned stories about females, because I was reading an article saying that a majority of stories just center around a male character or protagonist. Also, relating it back to the Oscars, Kate Blanchett, her acceptance speech, literally, was pretty much a paraphrase of that. She said, "For so bravely and intelligently distributing the film and to the audiences who went to see it, and perhaps those of us in the industry who are still foolishly clinging to the idea that female films with women at the center are niche experiences. They are not. Audiences want to see them, and in fact, they earn money. The world is round, people."
Exactly. That's what I'm talking about. Like, when I heard her speech, I was like,
"You go, girl.
You go, girl." That's what it's about. It's a paradigm shift. I have three nephews, and we talk, especially my 21-year-old nephew, we talk film all the time, and some things we agree about, some things we don't agree about, but his favorite film is directed by a woman, and he didn't realize it was directed by a woman, and it's American Psycho, which we could have another discussion about that, but the point is that he didn't even realize that that's what it was.
I've noticed, obviously, that the acting categories at the Oscars are separated into best performance by a female and best performance by a male. And I've read numerous blogs saying that the Oscars and the Golden Globes and every other award show, basically, should be segregated into female-male awards for all the categories, not just acting. Do you think this would bring about any progress? Or
personally, no. I disagree with
that. I agree.
I think that in the short term, it would shine a spotlight on great films and great female-driven films and great female filmmakers in the very short time. But very quickly, there will be an asterisk next to the award. Be like, oh, she won a Best Directing Award at the Oscars. Oh, but it was a Best Female Director Award. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
Like, I don't think that that's the answer. I think that if we do two things, if we focus on developing female-driven projects, either behind or in front of the camera, and great projects, which they are out there just waiting to be told. So if we support the development and production of those projects, and if we bridge away to the audience that I know is out there dying to watch these films, then the awards will come. Like, also what needs to change, like, just because you mentioned the Academy, is the Academy is, like, something like 70% men, white men over the age of 50. Well, no matter what, they're not going to. That needs to change. So I think looking at awards is, they're subjective regardless, right? We give out an Artistic Merit Award at the Vancouver International Film Festival, and it has to be a woman director, writer, editor, cinematographer. But it's not a separate segregated award. The award is special because we want to celebrate, and it's from women in film, and we want to celebrate a female filmmaker. It's not a special segregated award at the festival, if you see what I mean, the difference.
Yes.
So that's great.
So moving forward, you do have your festival coming up this weekend. Well, it starts today, the Vancouver International Women in Film Festival.
Mm-hmm.
And it runs until Sunday, March 9th.
Yes.
So what kind of programming is being presented at this year's festival?
Okay, so tonight, our opening night gala is Karen Lam's sophomore feature, Evangeline. Karen Lam is a local director.
Okay.
She's kind of becoming the Canadian, if not global, queen of thriller. So we're so excited that this is the first time we've had a thriller open the festival. So it's kind of exciting. And, yeah, she's a local success story for sure. She's just making inroads. So we're excited to show her film. And, yeah, we have screenings all week, and we have 33 features and shorts. Another thing that's really exciting, just to show the talent that's out there, we had over 500 submissions this year from around the world, and our submission criteria is quite high. You need to have three women or three roles filled by women. It can be the same woman, either writer, director, producer, lead actress, or cinematographer. So those are very strict criteria, and we've had, yeah, like I said, and the films are amazing, and these are films that the audience here in Vancouver wouldn't normally get to see. We also have panels and Q&As with visiting filmmakers. There is one panel that I want to mention specifically for your listeners.
Okay.
Because Saturday, in honor of the International Women's Day, our industry panel is called Catalyst for Change, and it's basically everything you and I are talking about right now.
Okay.
I'm moderating it, and has Lauren Davis from Telefilm and Maureen Davis from Super Channel, Candice Elzinga, who's
a casting director. Yep.
Casting director, yeah, did Elysium and lots of local and American projects. Lindsay Hodgson, who is a distributor from Pacific Northwest Pictures, and Shauna Hardy-Mishaw, who's the executive director and founder of the Whistler Film Festival. So what I've done is I've brought together these decision makers to help to give their perspective, but to help us create sort of like a vision moving forward of how this paradigm shift can take place. And I want the audience to be filled with people of all, you know, filmmakers and film lovers, but also like new ideas. So I would love if your listeners come out and share.
All right, so that it's called Catalyst for Change?
Yes, and it's
Saturday, everybody.
10 a.m., and it's at the Vancity Theater, which the whole festival takes place. And then it's followed by a short program of the WIFD, so that's the International WIF chapter screenings, which we do every year. And they're shown at the same time around the world. So, and we have a local short in there as well, Carlene Kyle's The Weather Girl, which was Leo-nominated for Best Screenwriter. So, yeah, come spend the morning with us.
Thank you so much for joining me, Rochelle. I know the festival will be extremely successful this year, so good luck with the festival.
Thank you so much for this opportunity.
Thanks for joining us.
Yes. Okay, talk to you again.
Thank you, Karina. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned to CITR 101.9 FM for more of our International Women's Day broadcast.
The Clothesline Project was started by a group of women in the United States. Historically, it was a vehicle for survivors of violence to express their emotions by decorating a shirt. They then hung the shirts on a clothesline to be viewed by others as a testimony to the problems of violence against women. SASC, the AMS Sexual Assault Support Center, supports male, female, and trans survivors, and their clothesline is not restricted to only women's experiences of violence. Friends, family, and loved ones of survivors and anyone concerned by the levels of violence in our society are also invited to decorate a shirt. Clothesline 2014 will be hosted during the week of March 3rd to the 7th between 11 to 3 on the Sub Concourse. Please join us and bring your friends. Tune in to CITR 101.9 FM on March 8th, 2014, as we celebrate International Women's Day with 14 hours of programming. From 8 a.m. to 10 p.m., we will highlight female programmers, musicians, activists, artists, and athletes. Women's equality has made positive gains, but the world is still unequal. International Women's Day celebrates the social, political, and economic achievements of women while focusing attention on areas that require further action. Our 14 hours of International Women's Day programming is one of thousands of events throughout the world honoring the role of women. Join us on CITR 101.9 FM from 8 to 10 on March 8th and be inspired. For more information about the programming schedule, visit www.citr.ca.
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Rachel Bergen, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia. Thank you so much for being with us today.
So, for the remainder of today's program, we'd like to take some time to discuss some of the projects going on around the world, which are working towards increasing the quality and equality of life for women and girls. So I just want to begin by talking about the recent movement dubbed the Girl Effect. It began in 2008 by the Nike Foundation with, in cooperation with the Novo Foundation, United Nations Foundation, and Coalition for Adolescent Girls. And so the following information is straight from their official website, www.girleffect.org. What the Girl Effect movement strives to do is leverage the unique potential of adolescent girls to end poverty for themselves, their families, their communities, their countries, and the world. So understandably, if we were to include girls in education, health, and economic investment, we'd have a better chance of preventing issues such as child marriage, teen pregnancy, HIV and AIDS, and breaking the intergenerational cycle of poverty. So here are some statistics found on the website to back this up. In Uganda, 85% of girls leave school early, resulting in a $10 billion loss in potential earnings. By delaying child marriage and early birth for 1 million girls in Bangladesh, the country could potentially add $69 billion to their national income over these girls' lifetime. So I just want to end off with this quote on the website. It says, it's an investment we cannot afford to overlook, end quote. I thought it was a really interesting way to look at female equality by focusing on their productivity. And I just thought it was an extremely practical, logical, and a little bit cold-hearted to consider the economic benefits adolescent girls can give to society rather than just the ethical and moral standpoint.
That's a fair point, but I would argue that it maybe hits home for people who are more economic-minded. Like, this is the amount of money that we could be contributing to our national income. This is what we could experience if we actually gave women the time of day.
Exactly. This is Morgan. I'm replacing Nina. I do agree with that, Rachel. I'm studying social work, and a lot of the things that we've talked about are around women's equality has been around the unpaid work and how that's not really valued. And so I think it is an interesting spin to sort of take to look at how women, you know, it's not just unpaid work that is undervalued. It's the other kinds of work that women can be doing that's also undervalued. So I do think that's a pretty powerful message to be sending.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
And just looking more at their website, there's a bit about, what's her name? Fama Mohammed's anti-female genital mutilation rap. Mm. And just looking at the different things that women and girls have been doing around the world for not just for International Women's Day, but for women's rights. And this woman she's only 17 years old. And so what this piece is looking at is focusing on not only about what, you know, about women for International Women's Day, but also looking at what, you know, what young girls can be doing even, you know, before they are legally women. If you look at oh gosh, what's her name? That's terrible. The girl, Malala, right? And all the stuff she's been doing. And so really, really celebrating that aspect. So I don't know what you guys think about that.
Yeah, I think it's definitely important to not only recognize that while this is an International Women's Day, it still encompasses like the entire female gender. And the stories that we hear, like Malala's story, those are, I don't know, really, really powerful just because when you think about it, you're like, wow, when I was 15 or 14, like, I had absolutely no idea and not, like, such a strong grasp on what, like, female inequality in the world was like. And for these girls, it's always been so prevalent.
Maybe it's because we are privileged people. We grow up not having to worry about not being able to go to school, having our, you know, let's not go into details about female genital mutilation, but we don't have to worry about anybody going down there.
Yeah.
So we're privileged, and so maybe hearing stories from people who lack that same privilege it hits home for us because we can kind of resonate. Like, I don't want anybody going down there. On the same note as looking at women's rights, to mark International Women's Day, the nonprofit Catapult made a series of mock magazine covers. The fake magazines are called Child Bride, Good Slave Keeping, and 13. And they offer advice to slave masters, makeup tips to hide bruises, and they have features like boyfriend or pimp, the telltale signs he's selling you for sex. The point is basically to make International Women's Day more than just a cover story and to raise awareness about the brutal violations of human rights that are affecting millions of women and girls around the world. I was just looking at some of the covers.
They're really powerful. Like, Rachel had just shown them to me just before the broadcast, and I was shocked at, like, they're very bold statements that they're making, and I think it's fairly effective.
Yeah, there's just a picture of a girl on the cover. She's has a scarf on her head, and she's wearing a sari, and right next to it says, "Proposal Stories, 583 Tales of Rape, Acid Attacks, and Kidnapping."
Yeah, and it's...
Instead of, you know, Modern Bride, where there's a picture of a beautiful woman wearing this gorgeous dress, and she's, like, thinking about, like, invitation designs.
Yeah. Right? And for me, the powerful thing about this is it's looking at how a lot of Western media, it's not necessarily negative that it's, you know, that it's having a magazine about brides, but it also really focuses our attention on that aspect of it, and it just doesn't at all engage with the issues that are relevant to women around the world. It's a very narrow-minded sort of focus when they could be doing a lot more, like, even just brief pieces about, you know, this is something that is very relevant to many women around the world, and we should maybe in the Western world be thinking about it a little bit more.
Well, I know I just walked into Chapters a few months ago, and I went to the magazine rack because I tend to gravitate towards magazines these days because, you know, my brain can't focus for more much longer than 20 minutes on something, you know, grad school problems. But basically, the entire Current Affairs section was made up of Us Weekly and Hello Magazine, and just... Really? Not even, like, the Walrus or Maclean's even? Come on. Like, how are we supposed to be informed when a magazine rack is filled with that, you know, celebrity gossip masquerading as news?
Yep. No, exactly. Well, and I'm just looking at, right now, at 13 instead of 17. And I even find with 17 magazine, some of the stuff that they're talking about, it's like, ooh, I don't know if you should be pushing that on
17-year-olds.
And 17-year-old
girls. Let them
have
a childhood.
Yeah, right? Because this is saying, you know, like 13, it's talking about, you know, basically it's like the child sex industry. Mm-hmm. But even like some of these teen magazines are not necessarily pushing the best, the things that are best in mind for having a childhood. Because you are, you know, 17, you're not...
And most of the people who read that aren't 17 yet.
It's exactly.
Like, I'm looking forward to 17 when I'm, you know, an adult.
Yeah, exactly. I had a subscription, I think, when I was like 15 or 14, right? And like, this is what you're reading and what you're looking at. And
anyways, this 13 cover rocks the headline, 728 plus pages of hot street looks. How to run in heels, 6 fashion tips that could save your life. Man.
Yeah. And it's sad because this is a reality for many young girls around the world, and these are the kind of tips that they would be looking for, right? So that is actually time for today's broadcast. I'd like to thank everyone who has tuned in to our program, as well as to any of the other programming done by the women of CITR. I'd also like to thank everyone who donated to our fund drive cause. News did very well this year, and we just thank everyone who helped us out with that and helped the station and has allowed us to keep producing this kind of programming. That is it for today. I hope that you tune in next Friday, at 5, and we'll be having another full hour of independent news. I'm Morgan Yee.
I'm Rachel Bergen.
I'm Christine Kim.
And thank you for listening.